listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Prashant Parmeshwaran. Prashant, how's it going today?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for joining me. So on this episode, Prashant and I will be walking through a few recent issues that have come up in the Asia-Pacific and more broadly across the world. We're actually going to begin by focusing our podcast discussion on the big topic of the week, which is the so-called Panama Papers leak. They're sending waves across the world, and with good reason. After that, we'll move on to give you a quick preview of U.S. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter's upcoming visit to Asia. Prashant and I will kind of focus on our beats a bit more. I'll talk a bit about the implications for Carter's visit to India. Prashant will talk a bit about the Philippines. And finally, if you haven't read it yet, you should read Prashant's recent feature for The Diplomat on the U.S.-led Maritime Security Initiative for Southeast Asia. There hasn't really been a lot of reporting on that topic, and Prashant has probably the most thorough rundown to date, and I'll ask him a bit about that at the end of the podcast, and we'll wrap up. Prashant, to kick off, I guess, the big news this week, on not only in Asia but across the world, is this leak of 2.6 terabytes of data from Mossack Fonseca, Panamanian law firm, and the Panama Papers, as these documents have come to be called, essentially reveal a network of offshore financing for licit and in some cases legal activity, many cases legal activity, by several prominent world leaders, certainly several Asian leaders. And just to kind of give listeners the sense of why this matters, you know, what really struck me about these leaks is not that they suggest that world leaders are corrupt. In fact, you know, you look at Asia, and you look at, you know, Transparency International's rankings of corruption perceptions in Asia for the past, you know, 10 or 15 years, Asia really doesn't do that well. A lot of Asian states, especially in Southeast Asia, South Asia, even China, are known for being very corrupt. So what is really interesting to me, at least, about these leaks is how they reveal the plumbing that the world's elite and powerful people use to hide money from taxation, from governments. You know, there are legal purposes for using offshore holding companies for privacy, for bankruptcies, but in a lot of cases, these activities may turn out to be legal. So just to kind of give people a sampling of the Asian countries that have been implicated so far in the leaks. So in China, you know, Chinese President Xi Jinping, who has a highly visible anti-corruption campaign underway, his brother-in-law, Deng Jiagui, was named in the files, which is awkward for him. And also on that note, you know, China did announce that it would prosecute a former PLA general for corruption just a day after the Panama Papers leaked, and I think that might have overshadowed that news coming out of China. In India, India's been known for its corruption for a while. In 2011, 2012, massive popular movements really changed the character of that country's politics for a while. But over 500 Indians were named in the leaks, including several prominent Bollywood stars and businessmen. In India, this corruption issue really has a political sticking power, and it looks like it will turn into a major topic of discussion going forward. Similarly, in Pakistan, Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who really hasn't been the most popular prime minister, he faced many popular protests in late 2014, for example. His family was implicated in the Panama Papers as well. In South Korea, the former president's son appears among 190 other individuals. Also on the Korean Peninsula, the Panama Papers provide interesting evidence of how individuals have helped North Korea bypass its sanctions. So clearly, offshore finance also has use for highly nefarious activities, you know, not just limited to North Korea's nuclear program, but also possibly for terrorism and financing the drug trade. Prashant, do you want to tell us a bit about, you know, the situation in Southeast Asia? I mean, I'm particularly interested, you know, in a Malaysian Prime Minister, Najib Razak. His son also shows up in the papers. And maybe you can also tell us a bit about what's been going on with Najib and the whole 1MDB scandal there as well.
Yeah. So in terms of Southeast Asia, the majority of the firms that show up in the Panama Papers are from Singapore and Thailand principally, and then you have a few of them from the Philippines, Malaysia, and Indonesia. Some of the individuals mentioned are linked to prominent politicians or officials. Like you mentioned, in Malaysia, Najib's son is implicated. Mahathir's son, the former prime minister of Malaysia, also has his son implicated. And the Marcos family in the Philippines is also implicated there. And in Thailand, the chairman of the Thai Chamber of Commerce was implicated as well. With respect to 1MDB, I think the exposure, as you correctly pointed out, it's less about the sort of distinction between legal and illicit funding, and more about how the network of banking globally affects things. And with Malaysia, the issue with the link to the 1MDB scandal is the fact that the offshore entities that are implicated in this Panama Papers revelation are also a little bit reminiscent of what we've seen in the 1MDB scandal, because they're also involved offshore entities that were in the British Virgin Islands and the Cayman Islands, as well as a particular offshore entity that Najib received funds from, which were funneled to his bank account. So that's how the relation is with the 1MDB. With respect to the responses so far that we've seen, I think the firmest response has come from Singapore, which, you know, the Ministry of Finance and the Monetary Authority of Singapore said that they would really investigate and look into this, and if there is any revelation of illicit action, they're going to take very firm actions to if there is any evidence of wrongdoing. And that's no surprise, because Singapore is a major financial hub in Asia, so the Singaporean government really wants to get ahead of this. We haven't seen any official response from Malaysia yet in terms of them conducting a similar investigation, but I expect that as the more revelations come out with the Panama Papers, we're going to see a lot more of a response from regional governments, because these are some very interesting revelations.
Right, absolutely. Australia, you know, was another government to take strong action. In fact, right. The Australian government somehow has access to the 2.6 terabyte leak, which is unusual, since the ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, the group that has been working with these documents, hasn't released it publicly like some groups have in the past, like WikiLeaks. And New Zealand's government has also reacted. And I believe Indonesia's government is also setting up an investigation, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that's right. They are. And the interesting thing, as you mentioned, is some of the connections with the ongoing investigation. So in Malaysia, for example, the Malaysian Insider publication has revealed that it is part of the investigation with the Panama Papers as they disclose these documents. And I think that's one of the things that is interesting about these revelations, as opposed to WikiLeaks, which is that there really is a big investigative effort, not just with the individuals who originally released it, but a whole network of journalists and publications to really do in-depth reporting about what's going on and sort of disclose these things gradually so people can internalize them, rather than just releasing this whole bunch of information and people not knowing really what to do with it, which I sense was what happened with WikiLeaks initially.
Absolutely, and that's a very valid point. I mean, there are 400 journalists right now across the world working on these documents. The ICIJ will release a full list of companies and individuals that are implicated in the Panama Papers in May, so that's something to look forward to. And really, you know, as I wrote when I reacted to the Panama Papers in The Diplomat, this is really the beginning of something. These revelations are interesting, and certainly there have been people implicated already. You know, the Prime Minister of Iceland stepped down. As of today, it looks like David Cameron is facing some pressure over revelations that he had profited from offshore holdings right before becoming prime minister in the UK. So it's clear that there are political reverberations, and there'll be no doubt, you know, we'll see these revelations come to Asia, where corruption is obviously something that publics have been worried about for a while. But really, we're getting started, and this is going to be something that we'll be reading about a lot for the next few months.
Yeah.
Anyways, Prashant, let's take this conversation to the next phase of this podcast. And like I said, we wanted to look at Secretary Carter, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, his upcoming trip to Asia. So there's obviously, you know, two big legs to this trip that I want to focus on today, simply because we work on this. And the first part is India, and the second part is the Philippines. So do you want to give us a bit of a preview of Carter's trip, and, you know, we can continue the discussion from there?
Yep. So I think the big picture of Carter's trip is the fact that, so first he'll be delivering a key speech on Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York tomorrow, and Ankit and I will both be there for that. And then he'll be traveling to India and the Philippines, which will be the two big legs of the trip. And I think the big sort of meshes with the trip is, with the Obama administration's time winding down, and with several security events coming up in the region, one of them which is the upcoming verdict of the Philippine South China Sea case against China in May or June, the trip definitely comes at an interesting time. So Ankit, let's maybe begin with the India leg of the trip, and then I'll sort of talk about the Philippine leg. What do you think we can expect from his trip to India?
Sure. So I will talk about the deliverables, but first, I do want to kind of make a point about Ash Carter as an individual in India. So Carter's very interesting in that he is probably, the first U.S. Secretary of Defense we've seen in a while that has a very personal interest in India. As early as 2006, when the United States and India signed a strategic global partnership in the Bush administration, Carter then, he wasn't involved in government. I believe he was at Harvard, but he penned this big article in Foreign Affairs, essentially identifying India as America's new strategic partner. When Carter was Undersecretary of Defense of the Obama administration under Chuck Hagel, he was a big proponent of the DTTI, the Defense Trade and Technology Initiative, which allows the United States and India to share technology. And now, since he's been Secretary of Defense, we've seen a lot of big steps in the U.S.-India defense relationship. So I think that's interesting to know that Carter, he really is a believer in a stronger partnership between India and the United States, and I think we've seen that expressed in the way the U.S.-India defense partnership has advanced under his tenure as the defense secretary. And that's also helped in part by the fact that Obama himself, I believe, is a pretty strong proponent of this relationship as well. Anyway, so looking forward to his time in India. So certainly the technology transfer stuff I mentioned will be high on the agenda. There have been working groups meeting between the United States and India on aircraft carrier technology, for example. One of the big things that India is considering purchasing from the United States is a General Atomics EMALS sort of a carrier launch system. India is developing a new aircraft carrier, the IAC-2, the Vishal, and it may look to incorporate this technology, but it needs to clear some barriers with the United States to be able to do that. We've been hearing murmurs that India might be purchasing U.S. F-16s, possibly F-18s, although I really wouldn't put too much into those rumors yet, and I don't really expect anything big to come out of Carter's visit on that, but that will be on the agenda. In the fall, actually, Manohar Parrikar, India's defense minister, and Carter met and renewed the U.S.-India defense framework, which essentially is the agreement that sets the basis for how the United States and India cooperate on defense in a variety of ways. So that has, led to some recent momentum that we're expecting to see followed up. And there's actually three agreements that will be at the top of the agenda during Carter's time in India. And I'll just talk very briefly about these agreements since they're getting a lot of debate in India and they are sort of stirring controversy. But at the end of the day, none of these three agreements that I'm about to talk about represent anything revolutionary. More, they're sort of a foundation leading to a brighter relation, a brighter future for the U.S.-India defense partnership. So these three agreements are the Communication and Information Security Memorandum of Agreement, the Basic Exchange and Cooperation Agreement, and finally, the last of the three, the Logistics Supply Agreement, the LSA. I'll talk a bit about what each of them do very quickly. The LSA, the final of these three agreements, would set up a framework for the United States and India to share military logistics. If this agreement is signed, and let me point out that this agreement has been in the works since 2006, really a decade now, and it hasn't been signed. If it were to be signed, both New Delhi and Washington would have the ability, but not the obligation, to assist each other's armed forces with simple military logistics. And this would be entirely reciprocal. India wouldn't be obliged to really, help Washington do things that it was uncomfortable with. For the U.S. Navy, this would be a huge fillip because it would be able to use Indian naval facilities in a limited way to help it operate better in the Indian Ocean. The Communication Information Security Agreement that I talked about is probably the most controversial of these three because it would allow, again, reciprocal interactions and access to proprietary encrypted military communications equipment. And India might not be comfortable with the United States having access to those systems because it might shed, operational insight where the United States maybe has a conflict of interest, for example, with relation to Indian operations against Pakistan. The United States and Pakistan are allies, and India has obviously always been uncomfortable with that. So that aspect of this communications agreement is a little dicey, but otherwise, India has said that in principle, it's okay with that agreement as well. And finally, a basic exchange and cooperation agreement is simply a framework for exchanging sensitive data to aid in targeting and navigation. So that's really one of the less controversial of the three. Now, look, my personal perception is that we're not going to see these signed during Carter's visit. But I think this visit is, intended to build momentum towards eventually signing this before the Obama administration goes out of office. It is entirely possible that one of these, if not all three, might get signed during Carter's visit to create trust. And really, it is about trust at the end of the day. The United States and India have had their difficulties in coming together on issues like defense, but things are changing. The United States is obviously very eager to recruit India as a coalition partner in the Asia Pacific to uphold the regional status quo, both in the Indian Ocean region and outside there. And in India, this debate is interesting because there's always these trepidations that come up when the United States is courting India, because Indians are skeptical that a close relationship with the United States is necessarily in India's best interest. India also has a very developed partnership with Russia, and there are prospects of, you know, looking at how a closer relationship with the United States might affect that. But anyways, that's kind of my very quick preview. I have written about this at The Diplomat, so I'll link to that in the description to this podcast. But Prashant, let me flip it back around to you now and have you tell us a bit about the United States and Philippines. I mean, the Philippines has grown unusually prominent in Asian security, certainly in the South China Sea. The United States and the Philippines recently operationalized the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Act, and the Philippines has elections coming up. So really, it's an exciting time. What is your, you know, what are you expecting out of Carter's trip to the Philippines?
Yeah, so I think it's important to maybe compare and contrast briefly the two relationships, you know, India and the Philippines. So in the case of India, as you mentioned earlier, within the context of the U.S. rebalance to the Asia-Pacific, India is a very much a new partner for the United States. And historically, the relationship has had its share of ups and downs. And a lot of the agreements and proposed initiatives have to do with things that, you know, have the potential to be signed, but they haven't been signed already. In the case of the Philippines, what you have is an old U.S. ally spanning decades, and it's an alliance that has not, unfortunately, lived up to its potential in the last, you know, two decades since the United States was forced to withdraw from its bases in the Philippines following the end of the Cold War. So very much in contrast to India, Carter's visit to the Philippines comes on the back of significant advances that have already been seen in the U.S.-Philippine defense relationship, particularly, as you mentioned, the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, which was signed in 2014 and upheld by the Philippine Supreme Court in January this year. We've had the recent announcement of the first five new facilities under EDCA, the so-called agreement, and the United States and the Philippines will very much be looking forward to how they can cooperate within the context of these first five facilities. I would also point out that the visit, in terms of the overall context, comes ahead of the verdict on the Philippines' South China Sea case that was filed against China with the Permanent Court of Arbitration, and we've talked about this extensively in terms of the implications of that once a verdict comes out, expected in May or June. You know, another significant development within the U.S.-Philippine relationship in the context of the South China Sea is the increased Chinese activity around Scarborough Shoal, which is a feature that Beijing seized from Manila back in 2012. And so in the context of these significant developments, I think you can expect Carter to do one of two things. First, I think he will definitely affirm the importance of the U.S.-Philippine defense relationship and the relationship in general to the U.S. pivot or rebalance of the Asia-Pacific. And I think, secondly, he will definitely try to send certain signals of the U.S. commitment to preserving freedom of navigation and other principles, as well as safeguarding the security of its allies and partners, such as the Philippines, in the Asia-Pacific in the context of China's rising assertiveness in the South China Sea. Now, in terms of the agenda, I think the U.S. officials have remained pretty tight-lipped so far in terms of the exact defense announcements publicly. But what has been disclosed so far, what we can say is that, first of all, it's going to be very significant that Carter will become the first U.S. defense secretary to observe the U.S.-Philippine military exercises, known as the Balikatan exercises. He'll be observing the tail end of those exercises, which will be very interesting to observe. Those exercises, as I noted in a recent piece for The Diplomat on the importance of the Philippines to the rebalance, have not only been a bilateral affair, they've, you know, included Australia since 2014, and a number of other countries have sent observers as well, including Japan. So there's a growing networking of the U.S.-Philippine alliance as well that's important to note. I think, lastly, we can also expect some announcements on maritime security. Ideally, U.S. officials would like to be able to make some headlines on some capacity-building initiatives for the Philippines, including the Department of Defense's Southeast Asia Maritime Security Initiative, which I'm sure we'll discuss in greater detail, but that's sort of the broad sort of spectrum of things we can expect from Carter's visit to the Philippines.
And let me ask you, you know, one of the factors that you didn't address, but I'm curious about, is the upcoming election. Is the timing a little bit awkward with Carter visiting the Philippines right before an election and right before a change in leadership, or is the general idea that we can expect continuity out of Manila after these elections?
Yeah, I mean, I think the context of the elections is important in general. I think how the U.S. officials and Philippine officials would frame it would be that this is a great opportunity, actually, to institutionalize and concretize the gains that have been seen in the U.S.-Philippine relationship under the Obama administration and the Aquino administrations before we see a change of leadership, and then sort of cap some of the initiatives that we've already seen in terms of the relationship. That's how both sides have been framing this relationship. But you're absolutely right in terms of the worries that we could see with respect to sustainability in U.S.-Philippine relations. U.S.-Philippine relations under the Aquino and Obama administrations have been extremely good. And it's going to be very difficult to try to sustain this over the next few years, given the commitment that both sides had, but also Aquino and his former Foreign Secretary, Albert Del Rosario, who were very, very much in favor of a strong relationship between the United States and the Philippines. So we'll have to see how that shakes up in terms of the eventual outcome.
Absolutely. Now let's move on to the maritime security initiative, Prashant. This is, you know, this is one of those things that has been lingering on the Asia-Pacific security scene for a while, but we haven't really learned much about. And thankfully, I think you have one of the most comprehensive articles on it, so I'm glad to have you on to talk about it. So this was announced at last year's Shangri-La Dialogue, if I'm correct, right? Carter unveiled it then. And that was an interesting dialogue in itself because, you know, Carter and I believe it was a PLA colonel, they you know, exchanged some sharp words about China's island building in the South China Sea. But, you know, tell us a bit about this maritime security initiative. I mean, very briefly, you know, what is it and what isn't it? I mean, what is the objective of this and how is it limited? Because this isn't, you know, a blank check from the United States to these Southeast Asian countries. It's a lot more subtle than that. But what are the highlights?
Yeah, so I would characterize the Southeast Asia Maritime Security Initiative, or MSI, as the DoD folks call it, as a regional capacity building program to address a range of maritime challenges, chiefly China's growing assertiveness in the South China Sea, which I think looms very much on the horizon of Asia-Pacific security. And the primary objective is to build maritime capacity through initiatives like improving maritime domain awareness, expanding exercises, and leveraging senior-level engagements. But I think the primary thing that will be of interest to listeners is the fact that one of the focus areas of MSI is to enhance regional maritime domain awareness, working towards what officials called a common operating picture of the South China Sea. What this basically means is the United States is looking to work with Southeast Asian countries to improve their ability to detect, understand, react to and share information about air and maritime activity in the South China Sea, and that would include Chinese activities in that as well. And so this is very much a forward-leaning initiative by the United States to help Southeast Asian countries deal with this gap, massive gap, of maritime domain awareness between China as well as these some other Southeast Asian states. And the five principal countries that are involved are Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, Thailand, and Vietnam.
And, you know, let me ask you, my perception is that China's, you know, Coast Guard, Navy, and even the fishermen who often act as a proxy for the Chinese state have, you know, they've made the most of poor maritime domain awareness among these Southeast Asian states. So do you think, you know, when it comes to kind of a strategic approach to the South China Sea and actually preventing China's Coast Guard and these fishermen from making the most of poor MDA, that the MSI is ultimately a good approach for that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely one of the objectives. I think Southeast Asian states and U.S. officials will also mention that in addition to addressing this gap that we talked about between Chinese and Southeast Asian capabilities, it's also, you know, maritime domain awareness is also useful for other things as well, including addressing illegal fishing within these countries' waters, including humanitarian assistance and disaster relief opportunities. But certainly the China component is looming very large for these countries.
Great. Well, Prashant, thanks a lot for joining me today on the podcast.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening, as usual, and make sure that you do leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe to so you don't miss out on future episodes. Thanks for listening.